Hi, I'm Gab, and he's Jules, and this is a special episode of The Gab and Jules Show. And Jules, today we're going to be looking at the FC 100. It's our regular ranking of the top 100 players, top 90 players, I guess, and managers.
Yeah.
We split them up by position. People vote internally in the ESPN FC family, as you know. We've got networks all over the world.
Yep.
We've got relationships in China, in India, in Latin America, in Africa, in the US, in Europe. We've got our pundits. We've got our journalists. We've got our TV talent. We got everybody coming together, and they all vote. And there's no voter fraud.
No.
It's regular poll watchers.
Yeah. There's only a few winners. That's it.
And there's one winner every year. And people get excited by this.
Yeah.
Look, you know, my general view on Ballon d'Or, FIFA the best, and stuff like that, I'm always very careful to look at the criteria, look at what they base on. I guarantee you, you will disagree with some
for
of
sure.
the stuff. I guarantee you, dear listener, will disagree.
Yeah, we disagree on some.
I imagine I will use the word Muppet once or twice
over
the next 45 minutes or so.
Yeah.
Now, Jules, before we get into the winners, just a quick reminder of the criteria. And look, again, as I said, with awards, I'm not convinced everybody who voted follow the criteria exactly as I would have, which means it was incorrect. But still, so let's take that under advisement. You know the categories. Some of these obviously very straightforward: left back, central midfield, whatever. However, there are certain differentiations, right? We separated forwards from central strikers. The idea being that, you know, if you're Lewandowski, what you do is one thing. If you're Mbappe, what you do is slightly different. There will be overlap. There will be people in multiple categories. It's the name of the game. It's inevitable. The idea is to have a discussion about this, okay? So, dear listeners, if you can come up with better categories, then hit Jules up because he's very into his categorization.
Love categories.
All right. So here is our list of winners.
Do you want me to do drum roll?
Oh, he's good. He's good that way. Now, unsurprisingly, Jules, people at big clubs who win big things tend to finish top of these categories.
Hey, who would have thought?
I don't have any initial major problems with too many of these. We'll get into these in more detail.
Yeah.
I didn't vote for all these guys. I think you run into certain situations as well where reputation, how often you're on television, whether you win the big things matters. But you know what? I think that's okay with the criteria, no?
Yeah, I think so. And also the form of previous seasons maybe leading into last season, which is what we focused on to vote and cast our vote. So again, I don't think there's anything wrong by looking at last season, of course, and being the focus, but also taking in consideration what happened before, in a way.
I mean, one that might come up and might, and I think is kind of at the heart of the discussion, right? As we'll get to the manager situation later. But so you have a guy who won the Premier League, won it extremely well, historic title in Jurgen Klopp.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have a guy in Hansi Flick who won every single trophy that he entered. I think it was something like he won like 40 out of 44 games, something stupid like that. And you could argue, well, how does Klopp, who won one trophy, get in ahead of Hansi Flick? And then again, and that's where you have that debate.
Exactly.
You could argue that Klopp, you know, faced tougher opposition, that Klopp won by an enormous margin. And it comes down to how you weigh things up. Now, personally, I like to try to look at their work beyond results. I try to be more about performance. And this is done in individuals, but not everybody thinks that way.
No, you're right. And again, I think if you look at Klopp last season and Liverpool last season, you also have, in a way, to take with you in your thought what happened before, what Klopp has built there. You know, Hansi Flick arrived in a team that was already built, albeit not working well under Kovac before him and losing 5-1 to Frankfurt when he arrived. But still, this was made for him. Klopp had to build that team and put that squad together, which, again, you have to take that kind of stuff in consideration.
I think that that's a really good point. In the same way that, you know, if you manage, you know, the flip side, if you manage a big club where the tools are all there, you know, almost by inertia, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if Maurizio Sarri's on this list. We'll find out soon enough. But, you know, he did win a title. And then he got fired.
Yeah.
But then again, you know, that team had won the title for 8 consecutive seasons before that with other people in charge. So we'll get to all that. We're going to have some guests on, which I'm quite excited about because we've got Stuart Robson will be joining us, Natalie Gedra, and, of course, Mark Ogden. I'm sure he'll be grumpy about something. So here he is. Welcome, ESPN senior writer Mark Ogden. Jules, Augie is clearly cruising for a bruising because he's got an issue with the guy who ranks number one in the list of forwards, don't you, Mark?
What?
So the forward list is we've got Lionel Messi in first place, followed by Kylian Mbappe, Cristiano Ronaldo, and Neymar. Mohamed Salah is fifth, in case you're wondering. But you got an issue with Messi in first place?
I do have an issue with Messi, yeah. Not because he's a great, you know, generational, fantastic talent, which he is. He scores a lot of goals, which he does. But I think it's the games when he didn't perform that stand out for me. The games when he, you know, when he let Barcelona down. And we all remember the game against Bayern Munich in Lisbon when he was awful, absolutely awful. And I think sometimes when Messi doesn't deliver, his team really lacks that energy that he generates. You can never accuse Cristiano Ronaldo of doing what Messi did in Lisbon. Ronaldo always turns up.
You can't blame Messi for Barcelona losing 8-2 to Bayern Munich. I'm sorry.
Can you blame Messi?
All right.
I'm running to the rescue. Can you blame Messi for the fact that Barcelona didn't win the title or the fact that Barcelona had a slow start to the season this year?
You can certainly criticize him for how they blew the lead that they had before the restarts, certainly the advantage they had over Real Madrid. But, you know, again, there's a limit to what he can do on his own. When you play with Nelson Semedo and Sergio Busquets and people like that, there's a point where even if you're Leo Messi and you're 33 already, you just can't do it. But don't blame him for Bayern Munich. Come on.
I think, Augie, the debate here is when we look at these other players, and look, I mean, these are generational players. Messi and Ronaldo, their place in history is secure. Mbappe, I'm pretty sure, will join them. Neymar, likely, possibly as well. Look, the PSG fan. But, Mark, your point. So I think the point isn't so much. I think most would agree that Messi's season wasn't as great as past ones. Mm-hmm. Your point is that there's somebody more deserving than Lionel Messi to be in first place, right? So who?
Yeah. Kill me now, Ronaldo, because I think Juventus won a title.
So you don't blame him for losing to Lyon in the last 16 of Champions League, right? But you blame Messi for losing 8-2 to Bayern Munich.
I don't blame Messi for that. What I blame is I think if you had a team, right, two similar teams, I think Ronaldo would make the team better than Messi. Because I think with Messi, it's all about Messi. And with Ronaldo, you could say...
Whereas Ronaldo's known for being very low-key and not egocentric.
No, but
I think
as a team, Ronaldo can make a team better. I think with Messi, it's very much dependent on what sort of mood he's in on the day. Now, more often than not, he's in the good mood and he performs very well. But I don't see Ronaldo teams giving up the fight that Barcelona have done, not just in Lisbon against Bayern Munich, but the season before at Anfield, the year before in Rome. Ronaldo teams don't do that. With Ronaldo, you always feel that even in the 95th minute, he could do something. He's desperately trying to do something to turn the game around. With Messi, you don't see that. You don't see that Messi is busting a gut to do it sometimes. If he's not in the right mood for it, I mean,
Augie's a point. I'm thinking back to some of those times Barcelona were eliminated in the Champions League, and this is in past years, obviously, which, you know, shouldn't be included in this, but, you know, against Roma, for example, when, you know, with the comeback, when everything falls apart and he's just walking around the pitch.
Okay, but
Cristiano tends to keep going until the very end, I guess. Maybe that's the argument?
No, but, okay, the second leg against Liverpool, he created three chances in the first half. He was really good in that first half, especially. Right. It's not him. He can't do everything either.
So you put Messi first, and you didn't even put Cristiano second. You put this...
We're splitting hairs here because they are both superstar players. You can turn a game in an instant. But I just think that Ronaldo is more likely to drag a team with him to get a result by his own efforts. The Messi is, I think, if Messi doesn't want to know, he seems to go into a shell. And I won't say he sulks, but I've seen times when Messi just disappears. You never see Ronaldo disappear in a game. And that, for me, is the difference. I think Ronaldo can make the difference just when it matters. And obviously, Messi can. But on a bad day, he doesn't do it often enough.
What I think is interesting, and maybe we'll get to this as well, is I look at this top 10 and I ask myself, which one of these guys had the best season of his career? And other than Ilicic, although again, Ilicic after the restart kind of did little or nothing. In fact, was injured for a whole lot of time. I'm not sure any of these guys did have the best season of their career, and yet there they are.
In terms of numbers, you mean? Yeah, I mean,
or in terms of performances. You know, I think all of them have had better seasons in the past. All of them, whoever you went for. All right, Mark, let's turn to managers. Klopp won, Flick was second. We'll debate that elsewhere, Jules and I. But what struck me is, you feel very strongly, what stood out for you is the fact that Marcelo Bielsa, a guy who's not managing in the top flight, did get promoted from the championship with Leeds United, that he's so high on this list. And part of the reason he's so high on this list is I think you had him fifth. We've got Bielsa sixth overall. Now, I got to confess, I did not have Bielsa that high personally. Can you try to explain this a little bit? Because Bielsa is seen as, oh, look, you know, he's a loco Bielsa. He's loved by hipsters, blah, blah, blah. And people say, oh, what's all the fuss and so on. But you reckon he deserves to be this high, yeah?
Yeah, and as you know, Gab, that I wasn't one of those Bielsa sisters who was talking about. I didn't really buy into the Bielsa myth. And when in his first season at Leeds, I quite took some quite delight at the fact that Chris Wilder and Sheffield United got promoted and Leeds didn't. So, you know, I think that what you see is what you get with Bielsa, and we all know what he gets. But I think with Leeds, the first season, it was almost perfect, then it became a disastrous end to the season. They fell short. And, you know, to come back from that in the second season when Leeds had this real issue hanging over the club, 15, 16 years out of the Premier League, he stuck to his principles, didn't change anything. They had a wobble mid-season. And he got them into the Premier League. And I think in the Championship, as we know, it's a very tough division to get out of. Leeds have tried so long to do it. And he's become an absolute icon in Leeds. And it's a fantastic story that Bielsa is kind of proved to the sceptics like me that he has got something, and he's also revived a fantastic club like Leeds, which looked like it was going nowhere. So for me, it's a great story, and I think he deserves to be in the top 10 because the achievement of getting Leeds back to the Premier League should not be, you know, understated.
Yeah, I got to say, Jules, when you think about Leeds, for, you know, I think it's lovely for a northern city, and, you know, but the stereotype of Leeds is a certain stereotype of football in terms of history, club culture. It's Don Revy, it's bite your legs, Hunter, it's all this stuff. You wouldn't, more recently, it's David O'Leary and George Graham. You wouldn't associate it with somebody like Bielsa. It's not a natural fit true. At all. And yet, it's a love story, right?
Yeah, it is. And I think he, as we know, before he accepted his job, he always do like a deep audit into the club that he would go into. And I think he saw with the squad that they had at the time that there was a lot of players, young especially, who he could, make them understand exactly what he wanted. They will be willing to learn, willing to work hard. I think that's what he wants. And it's easier to do that than with superstars in another club, for example. And I think, for me, you also assess a manager's season on how much he's improved his own players. Of course, on winning stuff, and there's no problem about that, but also on how much you've improved your squad, you've improved your players. What you see with Marcelo Bielsa is how much he's improved Patrick Bamford, how much he's improved Calvin Phillips, how much he's improved Tyler Roberts or Mateusz Klich or all those players who were good players before, but Bielsa took them to another level. And I think that's also, when you judge a manager, I think that's what also you should take in consideration.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Gab. Just go to Indeed.com/Gab right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Gab. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. All right, Jules, I think that's enough Augie for this show. Let's move on, because we're joined in a minute by Natalie Gedra, who, of course, ESPN Brazil, but covers the Premier League, covers European football. welcome, Natalie, because you're going to help us sort something out. Because in the goalkeeping position, we have two people who finished level on points.
Yeah.
And they are Manuel Neuer and Alisson. I voted for Alisson, so obviously I think Alisson should win. However, Neuer got to win because the world is an unfair place. No, I'm just kidding. Neuer got to win because he had more first place votes.
Yeah, but how many more? 19 to 18. So even that was so close.
It is so close. Natalie, help us settle this. Tell us who you would have voted for, and tell us also who Alisson would have voted for.
Well, hello, boys. It's a pleasure to be here with you. Honestly, that was one of the toughest ones for me because I voted for Alisson, but I changed my vote so many times between Alisson and Neuer. And I was like, and then now I'm reading the list and I'm like, I should have voted for Neuer. You know, it's a very tough one. And it's so nice to see Neuer having such a great season, because not so long ago, a lot of people were talking about him and saying, oh, Neuer is a thing in the past. He's left behind by this other great goalkeepers, and Alisson, of course, was the number one example. And I'm absolutely positive that Alisson would have voted for Neuer because he is such a huge fan of Neuer. And then you're going to say, oh, but everybody loves Neuer. Which goalkeeper wouldn't like Neuer, wouldn't see him as a role model? But I remember a couple of years ago, when Liverpool was about to face Bayern Munich in the Champions League, I interviewed Alisson and he said, oh, and it's a shame because we don't know if Neuer's going to play. He was having injury problems, so we weren't sure that Neuer was going to face Liverpool. And then we ended the interview and I was like, yeah, it would be interesting to see you facing Neuer. And he was like, I'm so upset. I really want to face him because I'm such a big fan of him. I was very much looking forward to facing Neuer. And in the end, he did face Neuer, and Liverpool eliminated Bayern Munich in that Champions League a couple of seasons ago, but he's a huge fan, and it's very easy to compare both of them with their ability to play with their feet and everything, even though Alisson says that there is no comparison, that Neuer is the best goalkeeper in the past 10 years. So it's a very interesting duel between both of them.
I don't know, Jules. I can't decide, because I know Alisson is the nicest man in the world, and he's going to be extremely handsome.
Yes.
Almost Giroud. I guess Giroud has better skin, but other than that, they're right up there, right, Jules?
Yeah.
But I don't know. I kind of feel like Alisson would say nice things about anyone. Everybody. Like,
yeah, I mean, they're too. No, but the good point that Natalie made as well is that it's really rare for a player to reach his peak. And in Neuer's case, certainly 2012, 13, 14. Yeah. Was the
and then go
peak.
Down.
And then go down completely.
Especially when it comes to goalkeepers, because people say it's such a confidence position, which leads us nicely, actually. And then the other point, Natalie, when we look at this list of goalkeepers, obviously Alisson and Neuer, you can kind of put them in one bucket, perhaps with Ter Stegen, kind of with Ederson, in the sense that these are keepers who are very comfortable with their feet. They often participate in building from the back. But we have other keepers on this list who aren't like that, whether it's Oblak, whether it's Courtois, whether it's Donnarumma. You talk a little bit about that. They're these two very different styles of keeping.
Yeah, I think there's a place in mine and everybody's heart for all types of styles of goalkeepers, you know, because we see Oblak and how talented he is, because his strength is the shots stopping, like Courtois, like De Gea, like Donnarumma, and his positioning is brilliant. Sometimes we don't see Oblak doing all these very photographic saves, and because he's so well positioned all the time. And many people will argue, oh, but Oblak has such a brilliant defense in front of him, and this defensive style of play of Atletico de Madrid really benefits Oblak. But I don't think that takes away his merit and his talent. And I like both of these, like, school of goalkeepers. And in fact, Oblak was my third choice because I really appreciate how much he adds to Atletico de Madrid. And I think it's important that we keep this type of goalkeepers in football. It's not only about playing with their feet. It's about having these other skills, these shoot-stopping skills, and this positioning that he does so brilliantly. So I think there's place for everyone. There's absolutely a big place in my heart for Oblak as well.
Well, It's a good point. That's a good transition also to the other, our other topic, which is the central midfield category. Because looking at this list, I kind of feel, Natalie, that, again, we see two different types of central midfielders. And I'm going to be, and I know the best ones are all-rounders, are good at everything. And yep. He's going to get angry at me if I say that N'Golo Kante is not a great passer. But it seems to me that maybe N'Golo Kante, Jordan Henderson, Casemiro, Fabinho belong in one bucket, and maybe Toni Kroos, Thiago Alcantara, of course, belong in a different one, and maybe Joshua Kimmich belongs in both, and that's why he's number one.
But he's a freak.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with you, 100%. And I think before we talk about Kimmich, because he was just, oh my God, what a season. It was such a delight to watch him play. But this old school, if you see Fabinho and Kante, their main strength is to defend. They really did develop their passing skills, but I don't think a central midfielder today He needs to develop this kind of skills. He needs to develop his vision of the game. But you really see them shine when they are defending. And I think that's the case for many of them. If you see Casemiro and his leadership, his consistency, he incorporates the best of Real Madrid, even when Real Madrid is not at its best. So this leadership and how much he shows this strength on the pitch is very impressive. And if you see the other type that you mentioned, and you think about Thiago, for example, and Toni Kroos, it's great to see Toni Kroos playing like this at his 30s, you know? His reading of the game, he's so sophisticated, he's elegant, and he scores, he gives assists. He's the kind of player who really can change the look of a game, and especially the look of the midfield. And Thiago had one of the best, if not his best season in his career. He has this ability to bring a different pace and lots of good solutions in distributing the match. And if you look at Kimmich, oh, honestly, I melt every time I see Joshua Kimmich playing, because he just has it all. He has everything. And that's why he's on top of the list, because he's a ball winner. He has the tackles. He has the interceptions. He rarely commits faults. He retains possession. He has the passes, his long balls. And he is brilliant in two different positions, on right back, which is his original position, and on central midfield. And he has something that I really like, the intensity. Like, he's yelling at the pitch, and he's giving instructions. And even when he celebrates, you're scared because he's screaming so much, you know? So Kimmich has absolutely everything.
It is remarkable with Kimmich, Jules, that, you know, we're celebrating as a number one. And I might also add a third position, because, of course, he played center back as well under Carlo Ancelotti for a while. But people saw him as he's the heir apparent to Philipp Lahm in so many ways, because obviously this is another guy, a right back, a midfielder. But very different outward leadership personalities. You know, Lahm, who I think is one of Germany's greatest players ever, but nowhere near as outwardly emotive as Kimmich.
No.
And what I love, and Natalie, I want to get your view on this too. I think what we're seeing is that, you know, had we been doing this list 30 years ago, we could talk about styles like a Brazilian style, a German style, a Spanish style. This kind of all goes out on the window, right? I mean, the game is so globalized today, and Thiago Alcantara is perhaps the symbol of that globalization, because, of course, deep down he's Italian, because, of course, he was born in Italy. I'm just kidding. Just born in Italy by accident.
Both of you would try to claim him anyway. He plays for Spain, so he's got nothing to do with Italy or Brazil anyway.
All right, whatever. But you are seeing this, that, you know, you can't speak in those stereotypes, right? Can you remember back when we were growing up, since we're old, unlike Natalie, we was about like, oh, look, the German players, they're all disciplined and they're physical.
But don't forget that Claude Makélélé, I think, changed the game in a way of making that holding midfielder role so important now. And the Joshua Kimmich role, the Casemiro role, the Fabinho role in those kind of teams, it comes from there.
Had to be a French guy who changed the history of central midfield. Natalie, thank you so much.
My pleasure, boys. Thank you.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Jules, let's turn to defenders now, and maybe it's more what we used to call defenders, but maybe that's a bit outdated because a lot of the fullbacks especially really are, in my opinion, attacking players. So to help us sort through this, who better than our own Robbo, Stuart Robson, to join us. Robbo, welcome aboard. You've no doubt noticed this, that when you look at the list of right backs and left backs, these guys are generally wingers and midfielders. Many of them are wingers and midfielders masquerading as fullbacks, yeah?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, it looks to me as though now when we talk about fullbacks, we talk about their attacking qualities, but we don't talk about their defensive qualities. So most of them are either wingers that are being turned into fullbacks. They're players that get forward most of the time and concentrate mainly on their attacking play. That's why we see them as great fullbacks. But there aren't too many in the list that you've got there for the right backs or left backs that if in 1v1 situations are going to be good defenders. And top of your list at right back, Alexander Arnold, I think is a very poor defender, both in 1v1 situations and positionally. Because his whole game plan is around getting forward, getting crosses into the box, picking out great passes, getting shots away, which he's brilliant at doing. But he doesn't do the other side of the game, which is being a good defender.
Is it because, do you think they work less on that aspect of the game at training, for example? Or is it because for managers, it's worth more to have a right back that brings so much offensively that it would benefit more your team than having someone who is better defensively but not so good going forward?
Oh, you're absolutely right, Jules. I don't think managers or coaches work so hard on the back four now. They might work on a back three. They might work with the two centre-halves and a holding midfield player. But they still see the fullbacks as the players that are the outballs, that when they can switch the play, they can get the fullbacks high up the field, get crosses into the box. And I doubt that they do very much 1v1 defending. That used to be the key to whether you're a good fullback or not. Were you good in 1v1 situations? Could somebody try and take you on and you win it every time? I played with a player that I didn't see get beaten for about 4 or 5 years, which was Kenny Sanson. He was also good going forward, but in 1v1 situations, he never got beaten until Mark Chamberlain came onto the scene and beat him in the first game of the season against Stoke 1 year.
All right, that takes us way back there, Robbo.
I don't think I was born.
But I want to ask about this because, look, I think part of the argument is, and by the way, there are some defenders here. One of them, of course, your buddy Benjamin Pavard, who's really a central defender playing right back. But isn't part of the argument is most of these guys play for really good teams. Really good teams have possession most of the time. I don't need four big Burks sitting back on the halfway line. So, as you said, they are part of the outball. They are part of the attack. And I take your point about the importance for them defending one-on-one. But in the modern game, with so many teams that press, that's a big part of the job that the forwards do, right? We don't normally look at a forward and say, I don't like that Jamie Vardy because he doesn't press well enough. He doesn't do that part of the game, right? Whereas we kind of depend it. I mentioned Jamie Vardy. I could mention Neymar, for example, right? But then we kind of demand it from our fullbacks in a way that we don't demand the off-the-ball work from our strikers in the same way. I mean, does that make sense?
Yeah, I can see what you're saying. But I'll also go back, you're talking about pressing teams. So Liverpool are now a very, very high pressing team. But it makes the decision-making and the positional play of the people behind them even more important. And when I've seen a lot of the goals that Liverpool conceded over the last 2 years, one of the main problems has been that Alexander Arnold has made poor decisions, both positionally and when he's going to close the ball down or drop off. Quite often he then comes in field, he follows the ball, he gets played in behind and suddenly the opposition are attacking. And that's why Liverpool, when they haven't defended very well, have conceded goals. Because Alexander Arnold and Andrew Robertson down the other side don't make good decisions positionally and then make good decisions when to close the ball down and when to drop off. And that's something that you have to work on week in, week out, day in, day out. And I don't think coaches are working on that now because they're working, as you said, Gab, more on the pressing side of the game, higher up the field.
I'd argue probably coaches aren't working on it also because the fixture congestion is so high and the calendar is so mad, they simply don't have time to work much.
But also, I think it's a mindset, Robbo, isn't it? Because some defend, they just love the 1v1. They love defending, and others just prefer providing an assist or going score and running forward. And I just think maybe the new generation is more set mentally on going forward and creating and scoring than defending properly.
I'm just gonna look at this, right? On the left back list, we have Robertson, who I'm pretty sure was a winger before, and winger to wing back to fullback, right? Davies, we know, was a winger. Jordi Alba was a winger.
Yeah.
All right, Alexandro, fair enough. I think he's always been a defender. Rafael Guerreiro is very much a wing back and was a winger
before.
You know, these are the people that we have at the top of the left back list. Right back, Trent Alexander-Arnold was a central midfielder, right? Yeah. I mean, he's more of almost like a Dani Alves type, I think, sometimes coming inside, who obviously delivers a great cross as well. Hakimi's a wing back. Pavard it's more interesting maybe with a right back position because you got Walker, Pavard, who maybe are more sort of straight defenders. But then again, you get into Navas, who's a winger. Hattabor was essentially a winger, now plays wing back. You know, it's an interesting mix there, isn't it?
Yeah, but you also see Thorgan Hazard, for example, with Belgium playing wing back. So clearly, as we've been saying, that position now is more even for players who've never played as a defender before, ever.
Is there also something to be said, though, that we see more collective, you know, especially as teams press, right? I mean, you mentioned Liverpool and the goals that they conceded. Liverpool haven't conceded that many goals over the past 2 years, right? Liverpool have been a pretty good side, right?
Yeah.
That ultimately, if I'm Klopp and I look at this and I say, well, I'm going to press, I'm going to defend higher up the field, I'm going to try to rely that, you know, maybe on the offside trap or whatever, that I can get my alignment right. And I'll grant you, Robbo, early this season especially, there have been several occasions where Liverpool haven't done that. I'm thinking of the Leeds game, for example.
Yeah.
And I don't think Trent Alexander-Arnold's had a good start to the season.
No, Aston Villa, of course.
And the Villa game too. But generally, I feel like they defend higher up the pitch, but they defend more as a unit today, a lot of these teams, than they did in the past. Is that fair?
Yes, I would say you're absolutely right. But I was at a time, played at a time when, and I go back again, George Graham came in and he had no better defenders than Don Howard had under Arsenal. But George Graham worked on the back four all the time, day in, day out, with the two central midfield players. And it was a case of understanding their positional play. And quite a lot of that was pressing. Arsenal were, at that time under George Graham, were a high pressing team as well. But the defenders had to understand that they couldn't always go and press the ball when it wasn't on to press it. They had to be in good positions and they worked alongside the centre-halves. But Jules is absolutely right. It's the mindset of the managers and the players now about what you see a fullback's job. And the fullback now is very much the out ball, the player that's got to get forward, give you width, play little one-twos with the inside right, inside left, or whatever you want to call them, and get forward and get crosses in. They aren't being asked to do the defensive side of the game quite as much. And that's why you see more and more coaches, more and more teams play with back threes, because if you want your fullback, you were asking too much of fullback years ago, because you were asking them not only to get forward and overlap the winger and get crosses in, you're also asking them to be next to their centre-halves and be round on the cover. That's too far to run. And that's why you play with a back three now, because they start in the middle of the pitch, they can get forward quickly, within 20 yards, they're in an attacking position. They get back within 20 yards into a good defensive position. And I think we're going to see more and more of that as the way the culture of fullback is developing, that you're going to see more and more teams play with a back three, because it's going to be much easier for the fullback to do both sides of the job.
I think the textbook version of what Robbo's talking about is actually Leipzig and Nagelsmann, because, you know, Klostermann and Halstenberg they grew up as fullbacks. In fact, it's pretty attacking fullbacks, even though being German, I think they're both six footers or whatever. And that's exactly what they do. You've got Upamecano in the middle. You've got these two guys inside, but they're fullbacks. And when they win the ball, they go and they'll overlap. They'll come outside. They'll help build the play in that way. And
Sheffield United as well. Sheffield United play with centre backs who overlap because they could play wing backs as well.
Yeah, although the way Sheffield United do, I think that's even different because those guys are legit center backs clunking down the field who deliver a good ball. I don't know how Wilder does it while maintaining his balance.
He's, not so much he's this season anymore, to be
fair. Yeah, but he's got Basham Bauer back there. So, we got to show some respect. Robbo, thank you so much.
Absolute pleasure.
Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin underwear. The luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Get 20% off your first order at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. Save 20% at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
All right, enough guests. How about some quick hits instead?
Let's go, Gav.
All right, Jules. When it comes to goalkeepers, we're on the same page with Alisson at the top. I'm wondering, though, is it...
Manuel Neuer, you mean?
No, but we both wanted Alisson. It should have been Alisson at the top. Look, it was even, right? I got no problem with this. I got no issue with these guys in there. But what I am wondering a little bit about is, do some players... like? I would have thought sometimes you've got better keepers on worse teams, right?
Yeah.
Maybe don't get on television. It's anybody you want to highlight who you think?
I think someone like Rui Patricio at Wolves. Yeah. Because, I mean, it's the if you play in a weaker side with not a defense as strong as others, you will face more shots and you can have a percentage of save rates higher than others. You'll have more work to do. You know, some like that. Some like to having one save and making it. I just think Rui Patricio has been so consistent since winning the Euro 2016 with Portugal, where he was outstanding through the whole competition, won it pretty much not on his own, but was a huge part of that Portugal side winning it. And I think since then, he's been a really, really high level in terms of all his performances.
In fact, when we did the FIFA Battle of the Leagues, the Premier League manager, Mark Ogden, chose Rui Patricio as his goalkeeper. How'd that work out for him?
I remember. Right, Gab, let's move to right back now. And Trent Alexander-Arnold has won this. He's 22 years of age. He looks, if you look at the list, and Hakimi is second, Pavard is third, Dani Carvajal is fourth. He's way above everybody else, certainly in terms of what he provides to his team going forward.
There's no question. I mean, you know, earlier when we talked to Robbo, you know, he made the point about the importance of defending and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, football's about outscoring the opposition. This is what modern football is. And you look at his importance within that Liverpool team, which, lest we forget, in terms of creativity, before Thiago Alcantara came, I mean, I think he was by miles the most creative player, right?
Completely.
I mean, Naby Keita would have theoretically been that. So you look at the impact he has there. I mean, these are players who can disrupt, who are disruptors, I think, first and foremost. Right? They disrupt screams when everybody's... When everybody's back there, everybody's properly set as defensively, there's no gaps. We look to the creative players to either beat a man one-on-one or come up with a killer pass. And that is what this guy does time and again. So I think he's right up there. And interesting to see how his career develops. I always thought, man, he'll go back to playing central midfield. But no, he's got no reason to at this time.
No, you're right. I've been big love for Jesus Navas, who... has had an incredible sort of revival in that right back position at Sevilla. Fantastic. They won the Europa League with Julen Lopetegui. Not so sure about Hans Ateboa, considering Timothy Castain played in that right wing back position for most of last season with Atalanta.
Yeah, Ateboa actually played there quite a bit too.
But, you know, and Sergino Dest as well, the American young right back who's made that list as top 10, just right there at the end. I know you're not too convinced. It's a bit early for him, I guess.
For me, it's a question of body of work, right? I mean, half a season as a starter for Ajax. Look, promise as well.
Yeah.
So, Gino, if you're watching, maybe you'll be back next year in my list. I didn't have you in my top 10. Don't tell anyone. But, you know. All right. Center backs. All right. Nobody, I think, is going to argue with Virgil van Dijk. Sergio Ramos, I think, is the interesting one because, Jules, when we were talking about what people bring defensively, what they bring at the attacking end, what they bring in terms of intangibles, there's a certain school of thought that says Sergio Ramos is just not a good defender. He's a phenomenal footballer, phenomenal leader, but not a good defender. He screws things up. Is that fair?
I think we've seen him this season especially, but even a bit last season, although after the restart, they were so solid defensively that sometimes he gets caught out of position. He's got those laps of concentration. And I just don't think he's been great defensively for the last 2 years at all, you know. But you know what strikes me in this list, apart from the fact that there's six players, either French, Upamecano, Varane, Laporte, Koundé.
You can have Koulibaly too.
I've got Koulibaly. He's got a French passport. Or playing in France like Marquinhos, which is amazing. 6 out of 10, I claim that it's a victory. But no Italians. What's going on?
Yeah, well,
I mean, centre-backs used to be, they used to all be born in Italy.
Used
all
to the be
best
the
ones.
Operative word. I think I had Bonucci, who I'm not a huge, I think he's been on the slide, but I think he's still better than some of these guys on the list as a defender. Koulibaly, I feel, is kind of in there on reputation. Didn't have the greatest season. But then again, yeah. I mean, I think he's still one of the top five in the world, but fair enough. Chris Smalling had a great season. I know he's not Italian, but he certainly...
No, but Acerbi, maybe the best...
Acerbi, possibly the best center back in Serie A. So, you know what it is with center backs? It takes a while. I think it takes a while for them to be good because Dia Upamecano is still very young. But it takes a while for them to be recognized. You know, there's always like a lag there.
Yeah.
And, you know, and sometimes they stay at smaller teams until like, hey, this Virgil van Dijk guy, he's pretty good. You know, and other times, you know, they get recognized earlier. But in general, you have this process where, you know, and once you're there, you stay in there on rep. I mean, I'm sure plenty of people had Chiellini in their top 10 for not a fair reason. Didn't even play.
Let's move to left back now, and Andrew Robertson wins it again. I think, despite Alphonso Davies' incredible second part of the season, certainly after he got into the team, once David Alaba has moved to centre back, let's say from November onwards, pretty incredible. But Robertson, again, a bit like Trent Alexander-Arnold, by far the best left back, you would say? Or is it a bit closer?
I think it's closer. I think what Andy Robertson benefits from a lot is a team that's incredibly well coached, that doesn't necessarily, you know, when the guy on the other side is your team's best creative passer and you're getting balls for him, you know, I think he has a lot, because he's got such great players around him, because the team is so good, I think it's a lot easier for him.
Okay.
I think if he was on a different team, you know, where maybe he was the star player, I think it would be a different situation for him. But that said, I mean, you know, if he's not number one, he's number two or three.
Yeah. No,
right?
No, you're right.
And I do find it difficult with left backs, Jules, because Alphonso Davies obviously is a winger. What we all loved about him was his tremendous recovery speed, which helps make up, which means he can take more gambles defensively, right?
Completely.
But, you know, we don't know if his future even is at left back. You know, this season, obviously, we've seen Lucas Hernandez play more at left back. Yep. Davies has also had injuries. So it's out there. I do feel a little bit that the next gen here, if you want to call it that, you know, we have Reguilón in sixth place, Theo Hernandez in seventh place, Chilwell in eighth place. I would expect those guys to move up near the top. I think people ahead of them, and yeah, I'm looking at you, Alexandro, and you, Jordi Alba, in there a little bit on reputation.
Yeah. And Marcelo. Why is Marcelo doing in this list?
I don't know.
I thought he'd retired a long time ago, to be fair. This is an illegal vote. This is a vote that has arrived late and that we should not be. Stop the count. This is not possible.
Right. Let's move on to central midfielders. All right. Your man Conte, who's won it before.
Yeah, last season.
He slips down to fifth place. Look. If you're talking, and obviously we touched upon this with Natalie, right? If you're talking purely about defensive midfielder, cover every bit of grass, you'd still have him at number one, wouldn't you?
I think so. I mean, again, that game he had against Portugal last month with France was just incredible. He was just, when he's in that kind of form, and he has had injuries, and he's 29 now. He's not getting any younger, of course. And, you know, although he was a late bloomer for his career, he's played a lot of games and he gives so much. But when he's in that kind of form where he chases the ball everywhere, where he puts pressure, there's no one better to put pressure on whoever the opposition who has the ball. It's just fantastic, I think. And my issue, you know, the worry I have, and you and I have talked about that before, is once he retires, whenever that is, hopefully the latest possible. I don't know, there's not many like him, not just in France, but anywhere, you know, who have this ability of chasing the ball, putting pressure, getting the ball back, having that intelligence, reading the game so well. It's hard.
I think he's pretty unique. I mean, I think there's great defensive midfielders who have a strong presence. Some of them are on this list. I mean, Casemiro still.
Yeah.
Fabinho, of course. Mm. But I think those guys do it more. I don't think they have anywhere near Conte's dynamism.
Right? No.
Those guys read the game very well. They have a physical presence. They interpret the position differently. And Conte's evolution, certainly at club level, the fact that, you know, he's not the deepest lying midfielder.
No.
Whereas we think of him as a defensive midfielder, but, you know, he's further forward.
Yeah.
I think that's really remarkable. And he's pretty unique. And then when he goes and plays with the national team, you know, his position changes again because there he often is, the guy in front of the back four.
Yeah, exactly. And we talked about the next gen for the left back. There's a next gen for the central midfielder coming soon. Not in the list so much, but Barella.
Here we go, Camavinga.
You said it, not me. Now if you mention it, then I said, like, this is probably the last year that Eduardo Camavinga is not on this list.
I tell you what, Barella, I had him in my list this year. I think he's ready. I think he's there. No question about that. And there's others. There's others we're coming through. There's often a lag with these lists. You know?
Yes,
and
of course.
We need to recognize that. Yeah.
Let's move on to attacking midfielders now, Gab. And I just think, again, this one was pretty obvious to pick for all of us. Kevin De Bruyne was named best player in the Premier League last season as well. He's the best attacking midfielder in the world, right?
Yeah. And look, I think what makes him a bit different from the others is that, again, he's somebody who grew into the position, right? He started out as a winger. You know, we call it attacking midfield in the formation that, you know, City's basically a 4-1-4-1 formation, right? Most of the time. And when he did his best work, he had one of the Silva brothers alongside him and Rodri or Fernandinho behind, right? You find yourself playing so far up the pitch and you've got so much license to move around. His passes are
the vision is just,
you know, the vision is tremendous. You know, it's funny, you could, in a different world with a different manager, you know, you could almost interchange De Bruyne and Thiago Alcantara, right? I mean, he could play Thiago Alcantara's position. What he has, I think, also, though, is he has much more of an eye for goal and he's a better dribbler.
Yeah,
and better penetrating, better runner. Mm. I think as an all-rounder, you know, it's interesting because this is a really wide-ranging position. We have many types of players on this list. But yeah, for me, I have no issue with De Bruyne at number one. And again, you look, if we're going to do a bit of next-genning on this, Kai Havertz is in sixth place.
Yeah.
We've said many times, a unique talent. I don't know if his future is in attacking midfield or if it's somewhere else on the pitch. I don't think Lampard knows.
No,
they're still figuring it out. And also Jack Grealish.
Yeah.
An interesting one, I think, no?
Yeah, number 10, for sure. Yeah, and certainly, quite a unique style, at least for English football, pretty good. I think Usamawa being in ninth position, certainly on the back of his final eight, well, the last 16, second leg especially, and then the final eight with Lyon has helped him a lot. Good to see Papu Gomez there, who deserved...
Papu Gomez. Come on, man, the Papu dance.
Bruno Fernandes is number 3, certainly on the back of January and to the end of the season with United. He had a great impact on that team.
Yeah, I think for me, naturally, when I look at this list, there is a natural drop-off between what De Bruyne and Muller, who, by the way, are so different, right?
Yeah.
De Bruyne is so elegant, Muller so clunky. But obviously,
for Muller, it's the same as Neuer, someone who had as his peak in 2014, then looked like he was not really, you know...
Lost his place in the national team.
And at club level, and then suddenly just revived.
I wonder if it may have been one of the differences between Muller and Neuer. I think Neuer did have a decline. I think Muller found himself in a situation where the club wanted to move on, change the way he played, and it took them a while to figure out how he could contribute. But you know, you talk about a guy who combines, again, he's not a technically gifted footballer, not by that standard.
No.
But you combine somebody who combines intelligence and athleticism, and it's incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, Thomas Muller is a freak athlete, first and foremost. And he's so, so smart. And some of these other very talented players on the pitch, by the way, if they had a shred of his athleticism or his intelligence, they would be far, far, far higher.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on now to basically the glamour position.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody matches this, just those first four names. Augie's got an issue with Messi, number one. We went through it before. Like, Messi and Cristiano are going to be 1 and 1A.
Yeah.
All right. I think we move straight to next gen. We thought it was going to be Neymar.
Yeah, but he might still be. He's only 28.
Well, yeah, but 28 already. His own teammate, Kylian Mbappe, pushing him.
Yeah.
He's going to dominate this position for years, Mbappe, right?
Yeah, I think he will. Whether he stays in Paris for 1 year or two more years, I don't know, whatever he wants, whether he goes to Real Madrid straight away or he stops in between somewhere like Liverpool or Juventus or wherever he wants, I think he's going to be, for the next 10 years, right at the top in our rankings, in the Ballon d'Or rankings, in every ranking that you want to do, because he's only 21 and he's already incredible. I think there's danger. There's danger for him, maybe to get a bit carried away, maybe to do a bit too much on his own, a bit like Neymar, a bit like Messi, that kind of stuff. But he's so intelligent. He's got right people around him. There's no doubt he would be there big time.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think the interesting ones is who will the others be? Who will the others who are going to go and really challenge him at that level?
You know, I was at the Liverpool game the other day watching Mo Salah. And he's 5 in our list, could maybe be a bit higher, ahead of Neymar, maybe you could argue. Depends. Do you see him staying at that level for much longer? Again, he's 28, I think. Or already could you see signs that, apart from the goals that he scored on penalties this season, for example, and yeah, he still creates and he still has shots and his XG is not bad at all, but there's maybe... For the style that he has.
I think there's a natural evolution when it comes to certain types of players. And Mohamed Salah is a guy who relied a lot on his athleticism, on his incredible, the fact that he moves so fast with the ball and everything. And then as you get older, as you accumulate experience, you know, you learn to kind of harness your power and you adapt. Like, he's not going to be as quick as he was when he was younger, but what he has, I think he's got a much better understanding of space, obviously a much better finisher than he was in his early years. So I think he can stick around, but he's going to have to evolve into a slightly different player. And I think what we might see is actually Salah playing definitively at center forward.
Yeah.
You know, maybe with Firmino being
or second striker,
or something to that effect.
Mm. Another very exciting position is wingers. And again, we put in that position the ones who will really, by definition, if you want, by formation, proper wide players. Sadio Mane wins it. Again, I don't have any issue with that. I put him as number one. I thought he had a really good season last year. Maybe not in the most flamboyant style sometimes, like a Jadon Sancho, or even like a Raheem Sterling or Serge Gnabry or Leroy Sané, who's not in the list this season because he spent most of last season injured. Do you have any problem with Mane as number one?
No, I have no issue. I think, as I recall, he was my top pick. I think Raheem Sterling is a phenomenal footballer, maybe better rounded in some ways. But I think Mane can do so many things. And also, he's a smart, smart player. You know, we often forget this because we see his quickness and we see his dribbling ability. But I think he's very intelligent on the pitch. Serge Gnabry is another one who's up there. You know, when I look at upside, you know, I think Gnabry's close to the ceiling of where he is.
Okay.
I do think Jadon Sancho can get a lot better. And if we're projecting forward, he would be one of the obvious ones, you know, who I would see maybe alongside Sterling near the top of this pile. Not sure about Eden Hazard at number nine, because obviously...
He spent the whole season out injured.
Yeah, he's had a lot of injuries. Yeah. But obviously, Hazard comes back. He's immediately in this conversation.
Yeah.
Although, of course, he too is getting older. He's going to be 30 or he's around 30, right?
30, yeah. And Christian Pulisic at number six, encouraging for him, maybe slightly higher than what some could think. But he saw some very, very big, like promising stuff when he was playing for Chelsea, when he was fully fit.
Yeah, I think with Pulisic, I think what's really going to define him now as a player is... How does he get on the pitch for Chelsea and how does Frank Lampard use him? Because he's really in a situation where there is so much competition for places in that front three. You can play on the right, you can play on the left, you can play him through the middle, second striker. But you know, as we said, it's Mount, it's Havertz, it's Ziyech, it's Hudson-Odoi, yeah. it's Tammy Abraham, it's, I'm probably forgotten somebody, you know, there's, you know, he doesn't have the luxury of having a team built around him to his skills, not yet. True. Nobody on this team does. So how he responds to that, maybe could make him a better rounded player. I think that's going to be very, very telling in his development. Moving on to strikers, Jules. Robert Lewandowski is number one. Nobody's going to argue with that. This was his season. Yeah. So, but I have to protest a little bit.
Ooh, I like a protest. You know I'm French.
There's no Zlatan.
That's a disgrace.
There's no Zlatan Ibrahimovic on this list.
Come on. We can't take this list seriously. If they're like... No, I mean, you could see why. You were not so sure about him having a new deal, for example, at Milan.
Yeah. And then I saw, though, what he contributed. And
You could see why he divides a bit opinions and why people say, like, you know, I'm in Team Zlatan. Others might not be. And certainly those strikers here in the list have, you know, pretty amazing still.
And this is the thing. I mean, I think he was very close to making it to the list. When you look at this list, I don't think nobody's going to argue with Lewandowski. Obviously, nobody's going to argue with Haaland. Benzema's been phenomenal. Harry Kane scored a ton of goals. Lukaku's been phenomenal.
Yeah.
Aguero is maybe one of the ones who's maybe in there a little bit on reputation. Yeah. Ciro Immobile, I mean, great kind season. Of Muppets can argue with that. Timo Werner, another one. Firmino doesn't score. And again, maybe Firmino, maybe we should rethink him. I mean, we shouldn't put him in the strikers, you know, because of the way he plays. But you know, he's still... It's nominally played center forward on a team that won the Premier League by a bazillion points. So, and Raul Jimenez, I think there were times last season where I think he really carried Wolves.
Yeah, he was.
So I can see why I would still, Ibra's in my top 10, I'll tell you know. But this is a position where I think unlike last year, you've had a lot of strong competition, a lot of guys turning in really good seasons.
Yes, Karim Benzema maybe even had the best season of his career, you know, and he was 33. Yeah, so you look at it, Harry Kane, and we mentioned...
No Jamie Vardy either.
No Jamie Vardy, no Danny Ings, who had very strong season in the Premier League. But
yeah, but Danny Ings scored more goals from open play than any other player.
You love that, when you don't count pens.
Yeah, well why pens count?
Pens count.
Okay, thank you, Sergio Ramos. Yeah, but come on, okay. Man.
Erling Haaland... He's in second place. I mean, as we've said, no one could have beat Lewandowski. But in the years to come, a bit like what we were saying with Kylian Mbappe, surely this is the one that he's going to win. And
yeah.
I remember the very good article, probably still available on the website, of when you pitch Haaland and Mbappe, the new battle like it was Messi and Ronaldo before.
Yeah, I think he was still at Salzburg. But I asked the question, will this be the defining, you know, rivalry of the next generation, of the post-Messi Cristiano era? And people said, oh, it's too soon. Haaland hasn't done anything. Well, he's done a thing or two since then, hasn't he?
Yeah, he has. And you know what? All those great players, as good as they are, could be nothing without a great manager, right?
Well, we've seen some pretty bad managers win, pretty average managers win important silverware.
True, you know. But still, I think my point is, I thought that was a really good intro to the
transition.
Come on,
to
that was such a good transition. Jurgen Klopp as number one, Hansi Flick as number two. We said before, do you look at how many trophies they won in one season? And in that case, Flick has won more than Klopp. Do you look at what Klopp has achieved, not just last season, but again, how he built that team and that Liverpool really, really amazing squads. Pep Guardiola is third. Is he on reputation a bit? Because City didn't really play well last season. They got knocked out in the quarterfinals of the Champions League by Lyon, where Pep messed things up massively.
I mean, I think this is where you get into achievement versus, you know, who is legitimately better, right? If you were to ask me right now, right, if I'm starting a team from scratch and I can pick any of these guys to manage my team and you ask me, ooh, do you want Pep Guardiola or do you want Gasperini or Hansi Flick? I'm going to pick Pep Guardiola. Yeah. I'd probably pick Pep Guardiola. Yeah. And I would also pick Ancelotti. But then if you're looking over, you know, the year that we had, Ancelotti got sacked by Napoli. You know, he signed for Everton, started the season well this year. But then, you know, end of last year, it's not like he pulled up many trees. So I think people who put Ancelotti in there probably did it because... He is one of the 10 best managers in the world.
Yeah.
In fact,
no,
he's
definitely
one of the top five. But over the season, for me, you know, you got to look at Gasperini. You got to look at Nagelsmann.
Yeah. Lopetegui as well. Lopetegui. I mean, great season with Sevilla.
in his first year.
Yeah, first year. Just well, after everything that happened to him, too, on the back of everything that happened to him.
Guy who's not on the list is Jose Mourinho.
Yeah. But Diego Simeone is on the list. When you cannot tell me that Atletico had a great season. They were knocked out by Leipzig in the quarterfinal of the Champions League because they didn't play. And I'm not sure he deserves to be in that top 10.
Yeah, I think in the end, when it comes to managers, you know, if I make a reference to that great poem by Khalil Gibran, where they're kind of like archers, right? They can select the arrow, they can take aim, but once they let go, then you have the wind, then it's down to whether the flight of the arrow is true. In other words, it's up to the people on the pitch to make it happen for them.
Course.
If they got good people, more like who are good at following instructions, more likely that they'll be successful if the instructions are good. So, and I think that's why we have such a disparity again among the managers.
Yeah.
Right. I'd say that's more than enough of our thoughts and opinions. To view the entire FC 100 list, head over to ESPN's website and let us know what you think. Did we get it right? Not me as in you're me, because come on, don't shoot the messenger. We're just part of a large pool of people who voted on this. In any case, we're going to be back on our usual show. Catch us on podcasts. Catch us if we're on TV in your part of the world. And until then, thanks for listening.
The 2024 NFL Draft heads to Detroit, and it's time to see who gets the job.
Caleb is a unique and special talent throwing the football.
And what sets them apart?
The Heisman Trophy winner is Jaden Daniels.
All of the greats were hired here.
Throw by Mahomes.
See who gets the job.
Are you ready?
The 2024 NFL Draft begins Thursday, April 25th on ESPN, ABC, and NFL Network.